You're listening to The Political Fix, the show that investigates a political solution combining the best of the left and the right. Hosted by political visionary and entrepreneur Rick Raddatz, political expert and radio broadcaster Jay Amernick, and me, journalist in all media Heather Vale Goss, The Political Fix reveals the answers we're all looking for. Get on board and get your fix. Streaming live Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, at politicalfixradio.com. And welcome to the show for Wednesday, June 11th. I'm Heather Vale, known as The Unwrapper. I'm a freelance interviewer on the web, and my whole mission in life is peeling back the layers of onion to discover the truth. Joining me is my co-host, Jay Amernick. Normally, we have a second co-host, Rick Raddatz, but Rick is on assignment today. What you should know about Rick, though, is Rick's a serial entrepreneur with a degree in philosophy, which led to his development called The Solution. Pentonomics is the philosophy behind the solution, and he talks about the political strategies of cap and prioritize, which usually form a lot of the backbone of this show. But today we don't have Rick, the crazy philosopher. I do, though, have my other co-host, Jay Amernick, here. And Jay is a strategic planner who helps his clients create and implement plans, goals, tactics, and benchmarks. He also serves as the bridge in Nevada for Israeli companies who want to expand their business in the U.S., and his development labs create smartphone apps and inventions. Jay, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
It's a little odd not having Rick here.
Sometimes we can't hear him for the first segment anyway. So
it's actually okay, because I know we're going to talk about it a little bit later in the show. But I'd be interested because you know, he and I were sort of at loggerheads about the concept of voting. And from what I understand, I voted yesterday. I didn't see the results yet. I actually fell asleep early. I usually stay up and watch the results, but I was just beat. But anyway, there were a lot of very close races, and people's vote actually mattered. So,
right. So when you say close race, are we talking like 10 people, 500 people?
Well, it depends on the race. I mean, it's, you know, the smaller pool of people voting, obviously, the smaller the margin. You know, when you're talking about a, you know, it's in Las Vegas, for instance, or in Nevada, I should say, that the entire state, assemblyman, those are very small districts. So sometimes it comes down to the wire. And keep in mind, these are just the primaries. So there'll be everyone will have another shot at it.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm noticing we've got the video going behind the scenes of Google Hangouts, which people can watch at politicalfixradio.com. If you're listening to the radio, this won't make sense. But Jay, you're looking kind of scruffy lately. What's going on?
Yeah,
I mean, you're usually so clean cut and so businesslike.
All right, we're gonna go a little off topic here today. Okay, so here's the deal. So when back in, you know, what I, well, I'm not okay. When I was married, my wife literally was shave every day, like she would hated it.
Right, because it hurts to kiss someone with.
Yeah. Right. Okay, moving on.
And
that's,
okay,
that's a different program.
So now that you're not married anymore, you think it's okay to just...
No. God. I'm getting unwrapped. It's too early in the morning. Okay, here's the deal.
All right.
I have had a great many people, and by people I mean women, say that they enjoy this look.
Okay.
It's been called the beat up for breakfast look.
As in, Marlboro, like, man, look.
You just look like you just got out of bed, and you know, because you know when you get out of bed, you look, you know, disheveled, you know, everything. So that's why it's called that. So, you know, quite frankly, if I don't, I mean, I'm going to shave later today because I'm going to the Las Vegas Chamber of Commerce event. But, you know, if I don't have anything going on, I won't shave.
Okay.
I'll be cleanly shaven tonight at the Las Vegas Chamber event, and as well as the other networking event that you and I are going to.
Okay, cool. So what happens at the Chamber of Commerce event?
It's an expo. There's going to be, you know, there's booths of all sorts, different businesses. You know, you get to talk to them and see what they have going on, what they do in their, what, and they do with their, daily life. I like to see, you know, where there's intersection with what I do and what they do, and see if we can work something out.
Okay, so the show is focused on politics in general, but to me, business kind of overlaps with politics. So what's your opinion as far as, like, what's the purpose of a chamber of commerce in this day and age? Is it still as important as it used to be to join a chamber?
Absolutely. For a couple reasons. One, I'll talk about the political side of it. There is a every larger chamber of commerce has a government affairs division, and they are engaged with, in this case, the guys at City Hall, the people in Carson City, and representing the interests of small business owners. In the state capitol and in the Clark County Commission and everything like that. So it's very important.
So basically they're like lobbyists for entrepreneurs?
They do have lobbyists, but it's more than that. They really work in conjunction. Now, some chambers of commerce, including ours, do something I don't personally agree with, is that they will endorse candidates. I don't think they should do that.
Yeah, okay.
Because no matter who's in, they have to work with them. And I think if you endorse somebody, the other guy gets in, you have a deficit when building that relationship.
Yeah. So are they endorsing local candidates or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I have the. It's in the latest their magazine that comes out every month. I saw.
So they remain nonpartisan, though, for the most part.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. No. There are Republicans, there are Democrats, and then here in Nevada we have several nonpartisan offices. Actually, the mayor of Las Vegas is a nonpartisan office.
Okay. Cool. And obviously, all the judges and sheriffs and the yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about that. So you said that the primaries just closed yesterday.
Yes.
And, you know, for the most part, I'd have to say it went off without a lot of fanfare. Like, I mean, besides seeing signs and posters all over the city, which we see all the time. I mean, they're always there. We saw a little bit more signs. But, you know, and you and I went to a few parties where candidates were there introducing themselves, shaking hands, that sort of thing. But if I had not gone to those parties, it didn't seem to be like, it wasn't really presented as, hey, everybody, I mean, maybe you need to watch the news every night, which I do not, in order to have gotten that message. But I just feel like it kind of came and went without a lot of fanfare.
Yeah, and I believe voter turnout bears that out. Part of the issue, in my opinion, is that they do this early voting stuff. So it's sort of like, it's like a month long process. I think there was something again, when I first was able to vote, I was very excited. And I remember going to the polls on voting on election day. And it was a big deal, you know?
Yeah.
And so now it's sort of not a big deal. And I think they spend a lot more money and I don't think they get any more turnout.
Right. Yeah. And, so, you know, and speaking of turnout, you know, Rick was saying the 1 week, don't bother voting. It doesn't make a difference. But right. And I shared this story with you guys off the show. I don't think I've actually shared it on the show. But when I was a kid, too, when I turned 18, that's the age to vote in Canada. And I was really excited to vote. And normally I would vote a certain party, which was the far left party. Now, the thing to understand in Canada is, at the time, and there's more parties now, but at the time there were three parties. One was the Progressive Conservatives, which was the right party. There was the Liberals, which was kind of left of center. And then there was the New Democrat Party, which was far left.
Okay.
So I would typically vote with NDP. And a lot of people my age did that. But for the most part, we were looking at it as a protest vote because we were lessening the strength of the other two main parties. It was definitely like a third level party. No one ever expected them to get into power in any way, shape or form, but they were there. And the more seats that they had, the less power one of the other two parties had. So we would vote as a protest vote. And 1 year, lo and behold, the leader of Ontario won, and he was an NDP candidate. And okay. And we were all like, wow, seriously? He actually won? Like, enough people got out and voted and said, look, I don't agree with these two parties. I'm going to vote for this one just to lessen. And enough people did that, that it actually got him into office. And he was in office for a few terms.
Okay. Well, that's actually, yeah, that's it matters. Look, it may not be, you know, sometimes you're voting against somebody. Sometimes you are. Sometimes, you know, you don't feel, you know, a lot of people say, oh, they don't have a choice. That's, you know, that's actually nonsense. That's you know, radical thinking, and it's not accurate. There are vast differences between candidates. So, you know, so for instance, when, you know, I remember a lot of people were protesting when I was younger, when Bill Clinton was first running against George Herbert Walker Bush. Oh, there's no difference between the two. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. but that was people on the far left who just, you know, who quite frankly were, I mean, so far left, they like Joseph Stalin wasn't, you know, far enough left for them. I mean,
so they didn't think Clinton was left enough.
Right.
Okay.
And if you're not left enough, you may as well be, you know.
See, that doesn't make sense, because life is not black and white. There's a range. There's a spectrum.
Right, of course. And usually the candidates that, especially for national office, like that, you know, end up representing sort of the left and the right, I would say mainstream, which is just sort of center and just sort of center left, just sort of center right. You're not going to get, you look what happened, because during the primary, you get all kinds of people. Okay. So on the far right, you're going to get Michelle Bachmann. On the far left, you're going to get Dennis Kucinich. Right. So that's and the two of them, unless they ran against each other, wouldn't have a snowball's chance in hell of winning, because they're just way too out there.
Okay, so the people that win are usually more moderate, more in the center?
Yeah. Now once they get in, so it becomes a thing that you know, then they just seem more radical once they're in, because it's the media, and it's a lot of other things that, you know, cuz that's controversy. It's not.
Right. So the media will spin it that they're farther left or farther right than they are, just to have something sensational to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah. because it's not, you know, so, you know, everyone talks about Congress, you know, the gridlock and this and that. They actually get a great deal done. Most things pass with an overwhelming bipartisan vote. But okay. How exciting was that to talk about? It's not. And usually those things are not, they're sort of wonky inside baseball type things that pass. So they're really not exciting to talk about. But there you have it. So.
Yeah, I guess I'm an old school journalist. I think that we need to cover stories in an objective way, not spin it just to make it more exciting. Like, that doesn't make sense to me.
Well, no, of course not. But that's what it is. And. You know, I mean, you look at it, you know, it's all over the internet, whether it's Mother Jones on the left or Newsmax on the right, it's all decontextualized and
right. And those are the outlets that should have more of leeway to kind of, you know, get behind a certain issue, because we know they put it out there. This is what we stand for. So,
right, okay. No, absolutely. Getting behind an issue is fine. But back it up with fact, not a decontextualized story or a sort of misquote or something taken, like I said, decontextualized, taken out of context, that just to suit your aim.
Yeah, yeah. So there's obviously a lot of that going on, and you know, see, my point of view is I think that. A lot of journalists want to be objective. A lot of journalists think that they're just storytelling. However, the outlets that they work for tend to be slanted one way or another. So basically the stories that they tell end up being colored by the slant of something that's much bigger than them.
Well, there's that, or they actually think they're being objective when they're not. Like, you know, I've heard this, again, from journalists who are right-wing journalists, and I've heard this from left-wing journalists. I shouldn't say right-wing, I should say liberal and conservative, because that right-wing, right, left-wing is far, far. But
yeah.
But both of them have said, this is the mainstream opinion. This is fact. You know, whether the issue is abortion, right? So I'll take it. So the conservative one says, most Americans don't think abortion is murder and should be illegal. And then the right one says, well, it's mainstream opinion that abortion should be legal. Well, it's a contentious issue, and it could be debated and everything like that. But for them to say that this is the fact, and we're basing the story from this, we're focusing the lens from this point of view, is biased.
Right. However, both of them, with a hot button issue like that, both of them are actually right, because you can find enough people on both sides of the coin to say this is mainstream opinion. Like, how many people do you need?
Yes, you're correct. But here's the thing. So the person on the left should recognize that about the person on the right, and the person on the right should recognize that about the person on the left. They don't. But yeah, all they tell you is half the story, which is, I talked to people and the, you know, and the consensus was this.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Okay.
So that's how you decontextualize things. That's how you spin media.
Okay, folks, if you wanted to learn how to spin media, there's your lesson.
Errors and omissions, that's how you do it.
Yeah.
Whether on purpose, or whether just because blinded by ideology, or just, you know, sloppiness.
Right, yeah. Well, see, I think that as far as it should go, obviously a reporter has to feel comfortable reporting on the story. So if a reporter, let's say, is pro-choice, they're not going to be comfortable working for a far right wing media outlet that wants them to only tell stories about anti-abortion stories. So, right. So people naturally gravitate to where they resonate. However, to me, that still doesn't mean that you should slant the story. I mean, tell it from the perspective of this, but however, there's also this. Right, like, you got to show both sides of the story, or it's not journalism.
Well, that's actually, you know, that's interesting, because I know that I'm sure there are outlets on the left that do this too, but the Weekly Standard, which is a conservative magazine, you know, based out of Washington D.C., actually has a column called From Left Field with a gentleman they have on staff there who writes from the liberal perspective in their very conservative magazine.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right, so let's take a break, and when we come back, we're going to have the top story. So we'll be right back on The Political Fix. I'm Heather Vail. Welcome back to The Political Fix. I'm here with my co-host, Jay Amernick, and before the break, we were talking about the elections, and we were talking about media bias and all sorts of fun stuff.
Yes. How you doing?
And during the break, we had an even more interesting discussion, but you have to watch the Hangout Behind the Scenes video to see that. Yes. And that's only on politicalfixradio.com. Yes.
Very good.
That's where we go totally off topic.
Speaking of topic, is it top story time, or are we there yet?
Yeah. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Are we there yet? He sounds like a kid in a car ride. Are we there yet? Are we there yet?
I was promised ice
cream. All right. Here's your ice cream, Jay. Great. Top story. Republican Tea Party forces are rejoicing, and the party establishment is somber or completely silent in the wake of House Majority Leader Eric Cantor's primary defeat at the hands of political newbie David Brat, who is completely against loosening immigration laws. Cantor himself conceded defeat, telling downcast supporters, "Obviously, we came up short." Brat and his supporters in the ranks of the Tea Party were triumphant. "This is a miracle from God," said the economics professor, who toppled the second most powerful Republican in the House in an upset that few, if any, in the party's high command saw coming. But as he looked ahead to November's elections, Brat declined to spell out policy specifics. "I'm a PhD in economics, so you analyze every situation uniquely," he told MSNBC in an interview, in which he said he preferred to keep the focus on the celebratory issues of yesterday's results. The victory was by far the biggest of the 2014 campaign season for Tea Party forces. Cantor's defeat was the first primary setback for a senior leader in Congress in recent years. The outcome may well mark the end of Cantor's political career, although at 51, he has plenty of time to attempt a future comeback. Aides did not respond last night when asked if the majority leader would run a write-in campaign in the fall. But the impact of Cantor's surprise loss on the fate of immigration legislation in the current Congress seemed clearer still. Conservatives will now be emboldened in their opposition to legislation to create paths to citizenship for immigrants living in the country illegally, and party leaders who are more sympathetic to such legislation will likely be less willing to try. Many Republicans say the party can ill afford to stick to an uncompromising stand on the issue, given the increasing political influence of Hispanic voters. In the fall, Bratt will face Democrat Jack Tramiel, also a professor at Randolph-Mason, in the solidly Republican district. Democrats seized on the upset as evidence that their fight for House control this fall is far from over. Cantor was appointed to his first leadership position in 2002 when he was named chief deputy whip of the party and became the highest-ranking Jewish Republican in Washington. It was a recognition of his fundraising skills as well as his conservative voting record at a time Republican leaders were eager to tap into Jewish donors for their campaigns. You know, this story has you written all over it, Jay. I'm sure you have a ton to say.
Okay. Yeah, well, first let me say this. Eric Cantor is a tremendous leader, and you know, when I worked for AIPAC, we worked with him closely. What's interesting is that he was somebody actually who was painted in a very bad light through a lot of smear campaigns. A lot of nonsense was said about him, which, you know, they got the guy that sort of looked like him pushing the old lady in the wheelchair off the cliff. Nonsense. Wow. Yeah, you know, it's stuff like that. None of it's true. And then they're going to find out if this gentleman Bratt gets in that, you know what, you know, all the people on the left are going to say, oh, you know what, Eric Cantor wasn't so bad after all. Because he actually represents the mainstream, but things get so polarized that you lose sight of what somebody actually stands for, and none of it. And you basically, it's actually worse than decontextualizing. They actually dehumanized him, which is done so often by both parties, and it's terrible. I don't know anything about this race actually, and as the story suggested, it caught everybody by surprise. I believe it was John Boehner's chief of staff actually called him and said, we had no idea. Otherwise I would imagine they would have, the mainstream, you know, the central party would have gotten behind him more and made more of a push. But I think in my mind, this is a tremendous loss, and I'm, you know, neither right nor left, but I think he was, you know, he's a tremendous leader, and it's sad to see him go, and especially for what looks like is going to be a further right ideologue who's going to, you know, give the press plenty of quotes to demonize more. So
yeah. Okay. Is this one of those situations that could have changed if more people showed up to vote?
Well, certainly. Yeah. Okay. I don't know a lot about Eric Cantor's district, so I couldn't tell you, you know, whether it was one of those things where, you know, it was so, he was so safe, they felt that don't bother, or, you know, or they defected and went to this other guy, Bratt.
Yeah, I have no maybe idea. It could be that they wanted a change. Like sometimes people just, in Canada, for example, the prime minister typically, if you look back over history, it's right, left, right, left, right, left, like back and forth. So, oh, we got tired of the right, let's vote left. Oh, we got tired of the left, let's vote right. So it could be something like that. Or it could be, you know, maybe Bratt is just a really good campaigner and got a lot of support drummed up.
Yeah, but someone who's been around as long as Eric Cantor has, as I'm sure, has a decent amount of money in his war chest, as they call it. So
yeah.
I'm not sure whether he was saving it for the general or what. But this is it's unusual. I have not seen any of the rhetoric. I don't know if there were any anti-Semitic overtones to any of it. I know there were actually coming from the left, from saying that he was a sellout because he is the highest ranking Jewish Republican. And things like that.
What? I don't get the what's the correlation there?
Well, okay. Prior to Abraham Lincoln, Jews mostly voted Republican. Since Abraham Lincoln passed, let's just say Abraham, post Abraham Lincoln, mostly voted Democrat.
Okay.
And that's an historic thing. Jimmy Carter was actually the first.
I don't see that because Jewish people are very good in business. That's a right wing thing. They're very good with finances. That's typically a right wing thing.
But overall, our look at any board of any 501c3.
Right. Okay.
Very good with philanthropy and the social justice issues, and that sort
that's
of
left.
Trumps those other things. Now, okay. Like I said, Jimmy Carter was the first one to really lose the Jewish vote because, well, he actually broke the law. He sent Andrew Young to the UN to negotiate with the PLO, which is a terrorist organization, which is against U.S. law. And it was secret. He did it behind the scenes. It was actually, and when that was found out, Jimmy Carter lost the Jewish vote, the majority of the Jewish vote. Now, that being said, the Republicans actually lost it. Again, through George H.W. Bush did not have it. And the first time around, George W. Bush did not have it.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
But now it's, now it's kind of interesting, but I think the Jewish community as a whole is becoming more diverse. And I think it's much more divided now.
Okay. So the fact that this Republican, Eric Cantor, was Jewish and presumably had Jewish support. Yeah. Okay. Is Jewish and presumably had Jewish support. So this was like a major thing that a Jewish Republican was actually a leader?
Not in Virginia. Because I see he comes from actually a very conservative area.
Okay. So why would the opposition be running an anti-Semitic campaign?
I didn't say anti-Semitic.
You said you weren't sure if there was anti-Semitic overtones.
Oh, right. No, that I have no idea. I mean, when I said opposition, I've seen things come from the left where there's sort of the hint that he's some kind of sellout or something like that. And I don't, I don't believe in groupthink. So I think somebody who's allowed to, should be allowed to, to vote with his conscience, and that's where he stands politically. So be he Jewish or not, that has nothing to do with it. And by the way, this should also disabuse people of the notion of this cabal of Jewish control, because here this guy just lost. So,
yeah,
you know.
Oh no, that's only in Hollywood.
Yeah, also not true.
Yeah, that's funny. So, what? I mean, obviously, there's a lot revolving around immigration here. So,
well, let me ask you a question. What is the source of that story?
Associated Press.
Oh, okay. I have no idea why it's so. I mean, unless that was sort of the tone of the campaign, that was the big issue was immigration, which I don't know. To me, that's nonsense. I think we have bigger fish to fry, and I think the economy is front and center.
Yeah. Well.
So,
if- if there's a lot of, if there's more and more Hispanic voters and they're immigrants, you know, that's going to be an issue for them. I'm an immigrant, but I'm a, you know, I'm not a citizen. I'm a resident. Right. So I have a green card. So like, it's the same thing for me, but I was never an illegal immigrant. I went through the proper channels. So,
right.
Yeah. So as far as I'm concerned, it's like, you know, that's kind of a non-issue for me personally is what, but I guess the issue here is letting illegal immigrants become citizens, but you know, aren't we just like splitting hairs? Because if they've been living here for 7 years, whether they filed the right paperwork 7 years ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago, if they've been part of the system and contributing to the system and now they want to be a citizen, I mean, like, who cares if they filed the paperwork? I don't know if that's such a big issue that we should be making a big deal out of it.
Yeah, I don't know. And the stuff gets so in the weeds. And I think a lot of it's based on fear. On both sides, you know, the conservatives are going to say, oh, they're, you know, we're getting overrun here and they've broken our law. Why should we give somebody, citizenship who started off by breaking the law? And the left, thinks it's going to turn back into, like some mass deportation back into, you know, some savage third world country where they're going to be slaughtered. I mean, I just don't know like where the sort of common sense is in this issue.
Sense would be if someone has been contributing to society as if they had done it legally and now they want to be a citizenship, let's make this path for them. However, if they have come here and are breaking laws and doing everything under the table and not contributing whatsoever to society, then let's not make a path to citizenship.
Well, I would argue then not breaking laws, because by doing what they've done, they've already broken the law. I would say like violent crime.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. A separate issue. But so here's the problem. There is that you have what I would call immigration advocates who sort of whitewash that, deny that there's that issue. I know I came I lived in Los Angeles for 15 years, and when I was there, the statistic was 50%, one half, 50% of all violent crime in LA County was illegal immigrants.
Wow.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
That actually shifts things a bit.
That's huge, right?
Yeah.
Now they would spin it and say, well, like, well, no, it's only like 8% or something like that. And I was like, no, that's statewide. Right. But in LA County, it was that. I don't know if that number's changed. I don't pay attention to California statistics anymore, but that's what it was when I was living there.
But as far as I know, and it might vary by the state, but even a legal immigrant cannot commit a violent crime and expect to stay here. Like if I go out and kill someone, they're probably going to deport me. Like you can't just.
Well, that would make perfect sense.
Right. Like you can't just legally immigrate to a country and then start committing crimes. Like.
Right. Well, like I said, and then that's the issue is that you know, neither side seems willing to sort of acknowledge the warts on their own side. Right. So the immigration advocates have to acknowledge that, you know, like this whole thing of calling them undocumented workers. I'm like, well, that doesn't really tell you what it is. One, they could be documented and they're just documents are forged or they are or they're expired. And who says they're working? Right. So that, you know, it's, you know, illegal alien is a legal term. It maybe it's a little ugly, whatever. Maybe we can soften that up. I don't know. But that's what it is. Saying undocumented worker.
Okay. To be honest, just on that undocumented worker part, I mean, we see guys on the strip who are handing out those cards, the card slappers. They're working, from what I've heard, they're working for like $5 an hour cash. Nobody who is a citizen of the U.S. wants that job. And then they're doing things like, you know, getting in trucks at 6 a.m. and being shipped off to do jobs that normally prison chain gangs do. Like these are not, they're not jobs that people want.
I'm not saying it's an ideal, you know, economic structure, but but that's what I'm getting. And then on the right, they should acknowledge that some of it actually comes from bigotry.
Yeah.
You know, because you see how they protest. They're protesting, you know, immigrants, you know, who've come in here illegally from Mexico or on a boat from Asia. You know, they're not targeting
Canadians.
Yeah, I've never seen the maple leaf with a red line through it. You know, or the Brits. You know, so. Yeah. And if you don't think there are plenty of Brits or Canadians here who've you know overstayed their visa and are not here legally, and you know what, you know I'm sure there are. So I think, like I said, you have to acknowledge the warts on both sides in order to come together, because that until that happens, neither side is going to sit down and talk.
Yeah, exactly. And there's probably a lot, because it's like you get 6 months to stay and you got to file all your paperwork and stuff within that 6 months, and you know it's a long process, so I'm sure that some people are, you know, in that in-between stage where they just haven't gotten around to it yet or haven't completed it or whatever. But yeah, so that's there. All right, so let's take a break. And then when we come back, we're going to have the inside perspective with Jay Amernick. And we'll be right back on The Political Fix. I'm Heather Vail. Welcome back to The Political Fix on Wednesday, June 11th. We're having a lot of fun here today. It's just me and Jay. We've taken over the show because Rick Raddatz, who is normally our co-host, is on assignment.
And leader.
And leader, yes. It's, you know, it's his political philosophy, Pentonomics, that formed the backbone for the idea for this show. So usually he's here talking a lot about Pentonomics and cap and prioritize and why everyone's wrong but him. But today, yeah, it's just me and Jay. And I've been having fun, Jay. This has been a good show.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
So now we're going to do Jay's segment, which is called Inside Perspective, because Jay has some amount of insider knowledge on how the political world works. So, Jay, take it away.
Thank you. So this week, I just wanted to talk about sort of capital P politic versus little p politic, and the difference therein. And this actually came up because last week you had mentioned that people said I was running for office, which I'm not.
People just assume that you are.
And that is okay. So that is what I call little p politics, and that is as sort of talking about what we've discussed a little bit today. Kind of the ugly side of it, the non-productive side of it. It's because it takes up, campaigning takes up so much time, so much energy, raising so much money and everything like that. So I've always been more interested in the legislative process, sort of what happens once someone's in office. That's the capital P politic. And that's where I like to focus my energy. I know I have a lot of friends who do political fundraising. I've been asked to do it, to work on campaigns. And the attractive side of it is that it's like a crazy couple of months. And it's, you know, and you, at the end of it, you feel like you've really like been through something. But at the end of the day, it's a fairly ugly process, I think. From the ads to the fundraising and everything like that, it's unfortunately necessary in our society, the way we run our democracy, but the rubber really meets the road when the lowercase p becomes the capital P, and that's really where the work gets done. Again, it's not as sensational, it's not as sexy as a campaign and giving a stump speech and railing on the other candidate or anything like that. But this is really where. This is really where it happens, and whatever happened with Eric Cantor and Brad, I don't know his first name. I'm sorry, it's a terrible last
David,
name.
It's David. David Brad. I know, is it not David Brad? But yeah, it's a horrible last name.
But so, for a politician. But anyway. So again, I don't know what was done here, but records can be distorted, everything like that takes away from, you know, Congressman Cantor's energy in Congress. And and guys spend so much time doing it. You can see it happen. You know, we see it on the national level when a president is about 3 years into his first term, he starts running again. And a lot of times you see their approval rating go down a little bit because they start getting involved in some ugly stuff.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to before, the guy who's been running the country becomes just another candidate, and it's not it becomes a little unseemly.
Well, their approval rating is going to go down once they're actually in the job doing it, because some people will expect them to do certain things and say that they didn't live up to the promises, and human nature is to focus on what they don't like. So rather than looking at, okay, well, he didn't do this, but look what he did, or look what he is doing, they tend to focus on, well, he screwed up here and here and here. And that's, I think that's why the approval rating goes down.
Right. Well,
it's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. There's a saying in Washington, and it is where you stand depends on where you sit. So it is easy for a candidate to say one thing. You know, when he's president, he's going to do this, this, and this, okay? When he gets in, especially when it comes to foreign policy, is always the big one. Everyone's like, well, he didn't do this, this, and this. And like, that's different, because when he was a candidate, it was one thing. When he is in office, he is under tremendous pressure from the State Department, tremendous pressure from the UN, NATO, other world bodies. It becomes a very different thing, and that's how things change. Again, we see it a lot with our senators and with our representatives. They say one thing, but once they get there, things change. And it's not that they get seduced by the Washington culture. It is just they see things that they didn't see before, because they're not privy to all the information.
Okay, so don't you think they should be a little more careful with their campaign promises and make sure it's actually something that they know they can pull off before they say that they will pull it off?
All right, so now I'm taking the caps lock off, and we're going back to small p, right? You okay. don't get elected that way, because nobody wants to hear how the sausage is being made, because it's complicated, it's boring, it's a little ugly, and that's the truth. Watch C-SPAN sometimes. If you don't know what's going on, you will literally, like, you know, it's like a cure for insomnia. Yeah. If you don't know what's going on, okay?
Yeah.
So they don't get elected by saying, well, the other guy just oversimplified the issue, and here's where it's complicated. Two sentences in, he's done. We live in a world of sound bites. And if you can't, you know, if literally President Obama won on hope and change, you know, those two words, right? It was something everybody remembered. Everybody said hope and change, hope and change, hope and change, you know. Nobody really knew what it meant.
Well, it's very inspirational, but there's no content there.
Exactly, right? So, if he had gone into, well, I'm going to do A, B, and C, and here's how we're going to do it, and here's how the mechanics of it work, right? Even a very good speaker such as him would have made us all nod off. So,
yeah,
that's why it's lowercase p. It just doesn't. There's really no substance there. It's all. It's like American Idol, right? You know, it's the flashiest and the bright shiny thing that wins, not necessarily the finest concept gets through.
So they're taking marketing 101 lessons and selling the sizzle and not the steak.
Yes, yeah, and hoping that once they get in, they'll be able to nourish you with the steak, but. The problem is that once you get in there, you got everybody trying to season the steak their own way. And some people want it rare, some people want it medium rare, some people want it well done, and you're not going to please everybody.
Wow, that's a really good metaphor, actually. I like that.
I just thought of it.
Yeah, I know. I'm impressed.
Thank you.
All right, so when people talk about politically correct, is that small p or big p?
Small p. Because it's disingenuous. Because again, okay, so again, we'll go back to undocumented worker.
Okay.
It doesn't really describe what it is. If it's obscuring the truth, or something a little more, forget the truth. It's obscuring something factual. How about that? Truth okay. is too ethereal and and philosophical, and Rick's not here, so I can't, I can't speak to that.
Right,
but,
okay.
But something factual, then that's a problem. So, you know, and I think it's small p. It's actually, if there could even be a smaller p than small p, it would be, because it actually distracts us from real issues. You know, it's worried about name calling almost.
Right. It's worried about being too blunt or
too. Right. And if, yeah. Right. You think about it like this, okay, you go to a doctor is not politically correct. The doctor will tell you, if you don't stop eating all that salt, you're going to die. Here's the proof. Here's the test. He's not going to say, he's not going to BS with us.
You're a little sodium enhanced right now.
Yes. Yes. And it could cause maybe an issue further down the way.
That could impact the livelihood of your existence.
Yeah. So he's done a disservice to you, and he's done a disservice to himself, because he looks like a total idiot.
Yeah.
You know? So sometimes, it's not, the truth ain't pretty, but there it is. Or fact ain't pretty, I should say. I keep saying truth, but fact.
Well, but isn't a fact the truth?
Fact is this. Fact is, water is wet, rocks are hard, right?
Yes.
Truth is more philosophical and ethereal and everything like that.
The truth is, water is wet and rocks are hard.
No, that's factual, though.
That is the truth.
Okay, no. It's factual, because it's
factual. I agree with you, it's factual, but it's also the truth.
What's truth? This truth would be like, what's the meaning of life?
We can't prove the truth behind that.
Right, but we can talk about it, and people
we can talk about it. Right. We can have a very interesting conversation. We can get really deep, but we still haven't established at the end of that conversation what the truth is.
So that's sort of philosophy's aim, is to find the truth. Science is to find fact. That's the difference. It's splitting hairs. Yes, water is wet, rocks is truthful as well. So maybe that was a bad example.
Okay.
But I got the steak thing good. So
yeah, exactly.
I can't come up with more than one in one day. You gotta give me a break here.
All right, so you're the political scientist, and that's small p political.
No, capital P.
You're the capital P political scientist.
Yeah, because I like the legislative process, where the rubber really meets the road, where the work gets done, what these people have been hired for.
Okay.
But some of them actually just like running. They don't like, they like campaigning, they like running, they don't actually like serving.
Yeah. So it's interesting too, I had a conversation with someone a few weeks ago, and he said he was conservative, and I said, well, you're big C conservative, but you're really not small C conservative. And he couldn't figure out what I meant. So, and then there's big L liberal, small L liberal.
Yeah.
So, yeah. All this political stuff. It like someone could do a mistype, and we'd be totally thrown off as to what they actually meant. All they have to do is forget the capital.
No, because that's figurative. It's not, unless I was writing an article about small p political, large p political, would it really make a difference? But if I was starting a sentence with the word political or politic,
yeah, then you're,
it would
you
have to be capital.
Yeah. But
even if I meant small p, and before this deteriorates into who's on first, we should sort of.
Yeah, we're not going to take the final break, because we're 2 minutes from the end of the show anyhow. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Look at that. Okay.
Yeah, so we actually filled it with the two of us. Wonderful. And no Rick's rant. Yeah, well, next week Rick will be back, and we'll have Rick's rant, which is his 2-minute rant on whatever he rants about, which kind of reminds me of the movie Network with the ranter. We're mad as hell,
yeah.
Mad as hell, and we're not going to take it anymore, and he rants it every week.
It's a Paddy Chayefsky script. That's actually it's actually one of the in Hollywood. It's known as one of the finest scripts ever written. Actually,
yeah, it's great classic movie. I love it.
And very prophetic too, because you can see what sort of reality TV turned into and what news has turned into. And they were joking about it back then, but
right. But you got to ask: did that color how reality TV progressed and how news progressed, or was it strictly a prophecy?
I think it was a prophecy, because it was a cautionary tale. Because
here was a guy. You put that story out there, and it's in mainstream. It's going to color what happens afterwards.
I think it was probably already starting to happen.
Okay.
Because again, look, every writer, every painter, every musician, every artist of all stripe has written, painted, sculpted, played music about one thing, and that's the human condition. So it's always a mirror of society. No one's ever sort of made anything up out of whole cloth and had it happen. It's literally this was happening. And again, back then, what was going on with the news was considered Paddy Chayefsky sort of made it hyper reality. But for the people who were like strict news guys, that's what was happening. Was that they were going after ratings, and that was never the purpose of news. It was, as we talked about at the beginning of the show, it was supposed to be objective, factual, this is what happened.
Yeah.
And without bias. So when they started to see getting more sensational and everything like that, Paddy took it to the nth degree, and there you have it.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, it was a great statement, and there's been other movies since then that have kind of, gone along the same kind of issues, and they're all fascinating to me. I mean, I love watching movies that are kind of making a statement on media. Because, kind of tongue-in-cheek. It's kind of like, it's like media commenting on media, entertainment commenting on media.
Right.
Yeah. Art imitates life. Life imitates art.
Exactly. Yeah. The Running Man with Arnold Schwarzenegger is another like precursor to reality TV.
Yeah.
So yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and the Truman Show, and there was one Ed TV. What was it? Ed TV? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then.
Yeah.
Broadcast radio, network news. Yeah, there's been
I would suggest even This Is Spinal Tap is, sort of.
Yeah.
It's a take on the music industry and making a documentary. And, I think all that stuff is very real. Again, again, hyper reality, but it was based in real situations. So.
Yeah. My favorite scene in that movie is where the interviewer is interviewing them, and he's like, "You're not listening to a bloody thing we're saying," because so many interviewers do that. It's like they have their list of questions. They just go down, read the list of questions. They're not even listening to the answer.
Yeah. Oh. No, they're thinking about their next question.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're not engaging.
That's the thing that could change with experience. I think if someone who's this, not everybody is good with both sides of it. Some people can be like very thoughtful interviewers, but then when you put a camera or a microphone in front of them, turn completely just,
deer in the headlights. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. I've seen that too.
Right. So it's the kind of thing that can be learned.
Right.
To not sort of feel that anxiety.
Yeah.
But a lot of them don't. So they're just so focused on the next question. Like, I got it out. And then they,
yeah. They conduct a questionnaire instead of actually an interview.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've reached the end of the show. And I think this was a really fun show. Guys, if you join us next week, we will have Rick Raddatz back. In the meantime, check out politicalfixradio.com. We have all the archives of the radio shows there, as well as behind the scenes videos where you get to see what we talk about when the radio is off and people are listening to commercials. So, be back with you next week. On behalf of myself, the missing Rick Raddatz, and my co-host, Jay Amnick, have a great week, and we'll talk to you next week. Thank you for listening to The Political Fix, the show that investigates a political solution combining the best of the left and the right. On behalf of Rick Raddatz, Jay Amernick, and myself, Heather Vale Goss, we're glad you chose to get your fix with us. We need reform to fix this country, and incentive reform is what will make a difference. The five economies and resources laid out in Pentonomics and the strategies we call cap and prioritize are the focus of Rick's vision of the optimal political future. Every week we talk about the answers we've dug up among ourselves and with political experts who have the ability to make change happen. Get on board and get your fix. Streaming live Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, at politicalfixradio.com.